It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Last week, Wisconsin's Natural Resources Board approved the Department of Natural Resources' new wolf management plan for Wisconsin. The DNR's previous plan had a population goal of 350 wolves in the state. Wisconsin now has almost 1,000 wolves, and the new plan sets a range from 800 to 1,200 wolves in the state. The decision comes after opposition from legislative Republicans that included rejecting several appointees on the Natural Resources Board. We're talking about Wisconsin's new wolf management plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on the DNR's new wolf management plan? Do you have questions about it? Are there changes you'd like to see made one way or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Randy Johnson is a large carnivore specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Randy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Let's take a look at the current or the last wolf management plan. What has been in place, Randy, now for some years here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we've had a management plan for wolves in place actually going back to the 1980s, but the most recent iteration was first written and approved in 1999. It got a small overhaul in the late 2000s, but much of that plan was really focused on wolf recovery in the state and trying to bring back this native species that had been extirpated in the 1900s. And so much of those plans were focused on wolf recovery. And so it talked about trying to grow those populations. How do we deal with conflict in certain situations and things like that? But as we know, the wolf population has grown and has recovered. And that's where this new plan comes into place.
One big factor in some ways out of Wisconsin's control, whether or not the gray wolf is currently listed as endangered in states like Wisconsin. This has gone back and forth over the years. Can you give us the latest and how it affects our wolf management plans here in the state?
Yeah, for sure. So we have our state management plans, but what we're talking about here is at the federal level, wolves have been mostly included on the federal list of endangered species over the last, several decades. It does go back and forth, but they are currently still on the federal endangered species list. And this has a lot of implications on wolves and wolf management in the state. Probably the two most impactful pieces are the availability of public harvest of wolves in the state, as well as lethal conflict abatement options in the case of livestock conflicts or things like that. So when they're on that federal list of endangered species, those options are off the table. And obviously when they're off the list, then those options become available.
Okay, so that's the background. Now bring us into this new plan just approved by the Natural Resources Board. Could you talk about the guidelines, the goal range for wolves in the state, and why we arrived at these numbers?
Sure. Yeah. So this plan, kind of bringing it full circle, it really moves our management program, our management focus into kind of alignment with where the population's at today. And that is, it recognizes that the population has biologically recovered, and it outlines, the management program for a recovered species. This includes, things like our conflict program, potential wolf hunting seasons, as well as a lot of other things like public education and research needs and collaboration, things like that. A big part of any management plan is trying to outline, what the population is going to look like, how many, where in the state, those types of things. And through this process, we've moved away from identifying a specific number of wolves as our management goal, and instead are focused more explicitly on, basically the things people care about, things like ensuring there's a healthy population, but also being responsive when conflicts arise. And we've outlined a process called adaptive management, which we can talk more about, but we've outlined in the plan that through this adaptive management process, we expect the wolf population to range somewhere in this 800 to 1200 overall statewide population size, but recognize it can be really variable depending on where you're at in the state.
Talking to Randy Johnson with Wisconsin DNR, large carnivore specialist there, looking at a new wolf management plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about this new plan. Do you have wolves in your part of the state? Do you see interactions between humans, livestock, pets, and wolves that worry you? Or do you think we're at a pretty good level right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Randy, let's dig into that phrase you mentioned, adaptive management. What does that mean when we're talking about Wisconsin wolves?
Sure. In a word, it basically means continuing to learn from what we're doing and get better at what we're doing. So implementing different management actions, whether we're talking about hunting seasons and how the population responds to things like the conflict abatement program. How effectively are we reducing conflict and helping those that need assistance, as well as the population itself, continuing to monitor and ensure that it's a healthy and sustainable population. It's an ongoing process. We implement these different actions, monitor, review, and ultimately try to improve as we move forward.
There have been concerns raised, I think, especially in parts of northern Wisconsin, that the wolf numbers, some people say, are too high, worries about depredations on pets and livestock. They're worried that the numbers that are going to be maintained here are too high and will lead to more of those conflicts. Can you talk about how you assess those arguments and weigh those?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's been a huge component of this process is, how do we balance out all the different desires and perspectives related to wolves? And no question, wolves can and do cause some conflicts. And often those conflicts, those impacts, if you will, are disproportionately, felt by those living and working and recreating among wolves, and in our case, in northern Wisconsin. So it's important to recognize that and try to work towards improving that situation. But at the same time, the science and in our own data, our experiences show that generally speaking, some of these conflicts are not well correlated with the overall statewide number of wolves. And this comes back to their biology. They live in packs and territories which occupy, certain spaces. And certain packs can learn to cause issues with livestock or pets, whereas most packs don't. And so having the ability to deal and resolve with those conflicts, where they're occurring at those locations, is the most effective way ultimately to try to reduce some of those issues. Whereas, again, most of the packs don't get into those issues. So it's having that site-specific abatement, which is a really important tool.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hey there.
What'd you want to bring up?
I was just going to ask how many conflicts we have record of in Wisconsin. How many of these, I would assume they're wolf attacks on livestock. How many of those do we know about?
John, thanks for the call. Randy, what do we know about reported numbers of wolf depredations, I think they're called, on livestock?
Yeah, sure. So this year we've had a little over 100 total reported complaints. And when we get a reported complaint, we work with our partners at USDA Wildlife Services to send out a trained biologist to investigate, look for the clues, the tracks, et cetera, and verify whether or not wolves were involved. And typically about 3/4 of the time they're verified as wolves. So this year, as of just a couple of days ago, we're at 77 verified complaints. Of those, a little over half, 2/3, are related to livestock, and the rest are hunting dog complaints.
John,
these numbers are generally on par with where we've been the last few years.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Randy, if it seems like, okay, in this area on these livestock farms, we seem to have a pattern of repeated attacks on livestock. What kind of tools are there to deal with that? And I guess we should answer in two circumstances. If wolves are considered an endangered species federally, which they currently are, and if they're not, which who knows, maybe next year they won't be.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So we unfortunately do see these situations arrive. We call them chronic farms, where they have repeated depredations or conflicts, repeated livestock being killed or harassed. And currently, with wolves being federally endangered or listed as federally endangered, we don't have access to the lethal controls. So we have non-lethal tools. We have financial compensation. You know, those non-lethal tools can range from anything from, you know, electric fencing, something called flagry, which is fencing related, to auditory flashing lights, those types of things. Anything that is a novel item introduced, you know, around these areas that makes wolves shy away. It can also be things like improved fencing, changing husbandry practices, some of those different, you know, behavioral changes, if you will. And all of these are kind of custom fit to the situation, to the farmer, producer, and also depends on if it's the first time something's happened or obviously if it's the 10th time something has happened. But in all of these cases, unfortunately, the non-lethal tools, wolves can become conditioned to these and they lose their effectiveness through time. And that's where the importance of the lethal controls comes in. There are certain cases where once wolves become conditioned, those non-lethal items lose their effectiveness. Sometimes the last step we can use is to lethally remove some of those wolves to get those conflicts to stop.
Talking to Randy Johnson, large carnivore specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. He's talking to us about the agency's new wolf management plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see the wolf population in Wisconsin managed? Do you have questions about the DNR's new plan just approved by the Natural Resources Board here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about wolves here in the state. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Wisconsin's new wolf management plan. Randy Johnson stays with us, large carnivore specialist for the DNR, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the state's new wolf management plan? Have you been following this story over the months, over the years? Do you have strong feelings one way or another about how we deal with wolves here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Go back to your calls now with Frank on the line in Springboro. Frank, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Yeah, you know, regarding the wolf population, I'm actually a local reporter up here. I've been covering issues about the wolves, and I've talked to, you know, Adrian Weiderman, some wolf experts, and, you know, the thing that always sticks out to me is that we're in Wisconsin, wherever you have a dominant wolf population, you don't have deer with chronic wasting disease. And I would think deer hunters would look at that and say, well, that's a good thing. That's what a healthy wolf population brings to, say, northern Wisconsin, and eliminates those deer that are sick or possibly sick, deer with chronic wasting disease. So I think managing a wolf population that eliminates sick deer is a good thing.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. Randy, do you take that into consideration, managing Wisconsin's deer population as you're looking at the wolf management plan?
Yeah, that's definitely something on the table. what he's referring to is some, I guess, relatively recent research in the last 10 years or so that's kind of suggestive that large predators, including wolves, can be effective at identifying deer that are sick with chronic wasting disease and removing them off the landscape. And, you know, it stands to reason that may be helpful in the long term to help control the prevalence of CWD. Now, it's also fair to say that the research is ongoing in this, and the final scientific answer, if you will, is kind of still to be determined. But, you know, at the same time, it's been well established through the research that wolves are effective at helping maintain a generally healthier deer herd. And ultimately that's beneficial to both deer as well as hunters.
Thanks a lot for that call. Randy, I understand in some cases hunters have been concerned, well, if wolves are eating deer, are there fewer deer for me to hunt come hunting season, not too far off? How big an impact does that have?
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to what scale we're talking about. On the statewide scale, you know, Wisconsin's deer herds are doing excellent. We've got lots and lots of deer in this state. So very little concern, very little impact at that population level. However, you know, at the very small scale, for example, some hunter on maybe a 40 acre parcel, you know, wolves can definitely impact the behavior of deer on that scale. They can change where they're at on the landscape. They can change their movement patterns, all kinds of different things. And these can definitely translate to, you know, impacts on deer hunting. And so, you know, not necessarily removing all the deer from the woods, to put it, you know, frankly, but they definitely can have their impact. But I think the same thing could be said for many things out there in the woods, right? Other hunters, vehicle, other recreators, all kinds of things. So it's kind of one more thing on the landscape that hunters need to be aware of and be adaptive to.
Let's go back to our callers. Bill is with us in Bayfield County. Bill, hi.
Hi. My question is, I'm completely blind. I can't see a thing. I can't see if the sun's shining. And I live right in the middle of Bayfield County. There are a lot of wolves in this county. And in fact, last fall, there was a male and a female that came up on the field behind my house, and they couldn't have been more than 150 yards away. What resources or tools would I have available? Because quite frankly, I'm concerned to go out of the house at night.
Bill, thanks for the call. Sorry about that's a worry. Randy, what do we know about safety of humans in places where wolves are prevalent?
Yeah, so it's always a concern, right? And people's comfort levels with wolves or really any wildlife, any carnivores, it varies person to person for sure. To be clear, we've never had a wolf attack on humans in modern times in Wisconsin. The times that has occurred in all of North America in the last 100+ years is I think, you know, less than 10 for sure. It's just a handful. That said, you know, there's still a large wild animal that deserves respect. And so it's important to keep that in mind as well. What we have for resources, in addition to some, you know, educational type things on our DNR website, is, again, partnering with USDA Wildlife Services. We have contact information posted on our website. Folks can call that at any time, 365, you know, days out of the year. And call to get assistance with such wolf conflicts. And that can range from all kinds of different things, just depending on the situation. But the best place is to call Wildlife Services and start that process to get the assistance you might need.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bill. Randy, before we run out of time, I want to ask about wolf hunting. I know a lot of people are concerned about that. Now, while the gray wolf is considered endangered here in Wisconsin at the federal level, no wolf hunt. But if that changes, I believe state statute requires a wolf hunt. How does that all fit into this management plan?
Yep, that's exactly right. If and when wolves become delisted in the future, state law requires Wisconsin to implement a wolf season. And so a big focus of this updated and new wolf management plan is addressing that reality. You know, looking at what would a future season look like as far as implementation, how can we improve it? How can we make sure we meet state quotas? And what have lessons learned been during the past wolf seasons held in the state, both in as recently as 2021, but also there were three seasons held back in 2012, 13, and 14. So really outlining improvements to how those seasons will be implemented in the future and really just being ready, being prepared for if and when that change in legal status comes to make sure that we can set up a wolf season that is well run, well implemented, but also provides quality opportunity for those that want to participate, all while trying to meet our management objectives and ensure that the wolf population itself remains healthy.
Let's go back to our callers. Rana is with us in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm excited to get the answer to this question. I have been wondering what first started in Wisconsin, what first started us trying to control populations of particular animals, wildlife? What was the kickoff animal and what were the circumstances and why did we do this, and how did it grow and evolve?
Rana, thanks for the call. That's a huge question for our last couple of minutes, Randy, but do you have thoughts on the history of why we for some species have this in-depth management plan?
Well, that's a good question. We, you know, from the DNR's perspective, we have management plans for some species and certainly not all. But I think with high profile species such as wolves, we have a black bear management plan. We have, I believe, turkey. We have a handful of management plans, and we're looking to develop more. You know, in today's world, there's a lot of competing interests, both from the human side on wildlife, but also making sure these populations stay healthy. You know, there's obviously a lot of ecological benefits. There's a lot of impacts to humans through agricultural damage, things like that. And so this is kind of the department's way, if you will, of trying to outline these programs, the objectives, the goals, the strategies, and trying to capture this in something that is digestible ultimately to the public and gives us some good direction. And then again, of course, continuing to update these as the decades move on to stay effective in an ever-changing world.
Rana, thanks for the call. In our last half a minute or so, Randy, now that this plan is approved, what happens next?
In the immediate, the short term here, we're taking the document and we're providing some final formatting. And so we're hoping to have a final document to post on our website and share broadly very soon. And then, you know, we'll get to the business of implementing the plan. I think one of the first steps that we'll look to do is bring together a wolf advisory committee, which includes stakeholder groups, tribal participants, or representation, DNR staff, and a wide variety of folks to, you know, start to get to the business of implementing this plan. And of course, all the while keeping an eye on that federal status, if and when a change might occur at that level.
Randy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Randy Johnson, a large carnivore specialist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He talked to us today about the state's new wolf management plan. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The 21 countries of Latin America, including South America, Central America, Mexico, parts of the Caribbean, are home to some of the richest and most flavorless culinary traditions in the world. And we have an expert on those traditions with us today for Food Friday, with the author of a new cookbook with more than 300 home-style recipes from all over that region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite Latin American or Latin American-inspired recipes, ingredients, dishes? Do you have a family recipe that fits the bill that you'd like to tell us about? Tell us about the best Latin American food you've ever eaten. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sandra Gutierrez is a journalist, food historian, professional cooking instructor, and author of 5 cookbooks. Her latest is called Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. Sandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Now, I'll admit, I grew up in a small town in the Midwest. Latin American food that I encountered was Taco Bell and not much more. We're getting so much more availability to food, not just from Mexico now, but all over the region. Can you talk about this region and the food it's bringing us, this great food it's bringing us in the United States?
Yes, your experience, you're not alone in it. Most people have tried Mexican food and that's it. And that is why in my book, I explain that Mexican food is the front door to Latin American cuisines. But once you cross over the threshold of that house, you will find 20 other kitchens inside. And each one is as exciting and as valuable and as vibrant as the next. It's an area that is very varied. A lot of different cultures have melded depending on the territory that they found themselves in. And so each country has a very distinct flavor.
Can you talk a little more about that melding of different cultures? Because, you know, I would have guessed a few different cultures, but actually there are people from all over the world bringing their traditions into Latin America.
Yes, and it's fascinating. The first people, of course, being the indigenous groups, the indigenous nations in Latin America, several of which, the most renowned, the Inca, the Aztec, the Mayas, but many, many more. And then, of course, the conquerors or the Spaniards and Portuguese, namely the Iberians that came and conquered Latin America and then brought the enslaved people from the Africas to replace the population that they had decimated. And after that, at the same time that Ellis Island is getting this massive migration from all over the world, they are also going to Latin American countries, and different groups of people land in different countries, in different territories, in different numbers. So, for example, you have a lot of Italians in New York, for instance, but they also went down to Argentina. They fell in love with the Argentinian land where they could produce wine, and it reminded them of home. And a lot of Germans went to Chile, for instance, which is the country right next to Argentina, producing two very different cuisines, and so on and so forth. You have a lot of Chinese, Hakka, and Japanese influence in Peru, and you have a lot of American influence, North American influence in Panama, and so on. They're all different groups of people, and of course, many more groups that meet in different countries, meaning the Jews, the Lebanese, they all meet with different cultures, like Italians, in different countries, but their numbers and the dissimilar combinations is what creates these flavors that are so unique.
Sandra, you've been through this amazing journey. What is it that you were looking for to find the recipes that were going to make the cut in this book to represent this huge region?
They had to be recipes that home cooks in Latin America that are contemporary to our cooks here are making today. So I didn't want any of the esoteric, rare kind of recipes that people, what I call the National Geographic effect, you know, that people usually think of Latin American food as being very exotic and very different and very frightening. No, they had to be modern recipes that have survived over time. So some of them can actually have indigenous roots, but that they're still being made today. They have to be easy, with ingredients that are very easy to find no matter where you find yourself. So you would not have any trouble finding your ingredients in your regular supermarket, with a few exceptions, and you can order those online, very, very few exceptions. And then they have to be practical, with techniques that the everyday cook knows how to do already. Because what I was trying to do was really make a collection of recipes for the modern cook of today.
It's Food Friday. Sandra Gutierrez is with us. Her new book is called Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite restaurant food that you've had from Mexican cuisine or South America, Central America, the Caribbean? Is there something that you've encountered and made yourself, maybe in your travels? Or are we talking about the food you grew up with? Love to hear about that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sandra, you shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's check this one out. A pasta con palta. Now, I looked at this and said, wait, this is pasta and pesto? Isn't that Italian? Hold on. It's pasta with avocado pesto, which I don't think I've ever had. Tell us about it.
It's a delicious, creamy rendition of pesto, and it is from Chile, the country Chile. And I find it fascinating that even though we all speak Spanish in Latin America, the words are not always the same. So palta means avocado, which of course most people recognize as aguacate. But aguacate is the Nahuatl or Aztec word for it. And once you cross over to South America, it becomes palta. The recipe is so, so simple. It's quicker to make than regular pesto. And it really is a mixture of avocado and walnuts, some salt, some garlic, some olive oil. And while the pasta is cooking, you blend this together in the blender. As soon as the pasta comes out of the pot, you combine it. And the avocado sauce becomes warm and creamy. It's truly delectable. Very sophisticated, and yet super easy and super inexpensive to make.
Sounds fantastic. Again, you can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, you start off the book with a bunch of sauces that we can make, represent that we're going to use in a lot of these recipes. On the Ideas Network Facebook page, Pete mentioned one of them. He's a fan of chimichurri sauce, which I think is from Argentina mostly. You've got a couple recipes. What goes into a good chimichurri sauce?
Yes, the chimichurri known widely through South America. It is an Argentinian sauce, and it's based on pesto. What goes into a really good chimichurri are fresh herbs, in particular parsley, fresh Italian parsley. You'll have some red pepper flakes. You'll have quality red wine vinegar and olive oil. And then that's where the variations begin. Because if you go to Central America, they have replaced the parsley with cilantro. And many Argentinians will add tomato to their chimichurri, and some will add carrots and celery to their chimichurri. So it's basically an herb sauce used as an accoutrement or a side or a topping to steaks and to other protein. It really is delicious. The two recipes that I picked are very different, and I do offer variations in the book so people can taste what similar foods in different countries are like.
Now, I said chimichurri is Argentinian, and you agreed. Are there foods where, like, there are arguments from one country to the next or one region to the next? Like, no, we invented that. You borrowed it.
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, there are many of those, of course. I would say even within the same country, and that's why I stay away from the word authentic, because if a Guatemalan grandmother is making arroz con pollo, which is chicken and rice, in their home and adding capers and olives, but her neighbor next door to her is actually adding peas and carrots, who is to say which one is authentic and which one isn't when they're both amazing, and they're both the same variety of ingredients going into a pot with a few differences. That happens throughout Latin America, but we have become used to that because the variations of recipes that are repeated throughout Latin America makes each unique. For example, I'll tell you the simple sauce that came from the Spaniards, who themselves got it from the Persians, sofrito, and that is the mirepoix, which is the French flavor base of Latin American cuisine. Sofrito started by being just a mixture of onions and olive oil that were cooked, and that would be the base to a recipe. But once you cross over to the Americas, you start getting different countries adding different ingredients. So for example, in Cuba, you'll have them add bell peppers and tomato and achiote, which is annatto. Annatto, of course, is what makes cheddar cheese orange. So you've all had annatto, even though it sounds like a foreign ingredient.
Oh, here in Wisconsin, we've eaten a lot of it, yes.
You've had cheddar cheese in Wisconsin, I know that. So you're familiar with that. But the Cubans will add that to their sofrito, making it a completely different color. And then in Central America, you have the additions of tomatoes on top of that, and so on and so forth. In Puerto Rico, you will not have any tomatoes. You will actually have an herb called culantro, which is a sawtooth cilantro, it's called. It's a long leaf cilantro, very different from what we typically know as cilantro in the rest of the Americas. So every country added their own ingredient, making one recipe into many. And that is why I tell you we're used to having these competitions of we made it first. It really doesn't matter. It's who makes it last that matters, I think.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to food writer Sandra Gutierrez about her new cookbook, Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've traveled to Mexico, Central America, South America, or the Caribbean, do you have some favorite foods you encountered along the way? If your family has origins in Latin America, what are some of your family's favorite dishes? The food you grew up with, have you modified it for life here in Wisconsin along the way? Do you have favorite dishes or questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up our Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Sandra Gutierrez, food writer and author of the new cookbook, Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. We're talking about dishes from all over the Caribbean, South and Central America, up to Mexico. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about food that you like, that you love, that you want to know more about, that you want to know how to make that one particular thing you had at a restaurant or while traveling? Or did you grow up with food from one of these traditions we're talking about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or I don't know, maybe you're calling for some takeout. based on this conversation. Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Sandra, we've got another recipe you shared with us up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, growing up, in Michigan, plantains, I wouldn't have known. Is that a banana? They weren't at stores. Now they're all over the place, easy to find even at non-specialty grocery stores. I love them. I can't get enough of them. You've got Platanos con Tocino, or plantain and bacon hash. So this is plantains, bacon, and eggs, a winner in my book. Tell us about the recipe.
Absolutely. I wanted to include ingredients that are not traditionally Latin American and, however, have made one of the biggest impacts in our food. And one of those is plantains. They actually come from Africa. Mm-hmm. And when they're green, they're used as a vegetable. They are starchy and they can be used as a potato. You can fry it into fries and mash it into mashes, you know, like mashed potatoes. But when they're sweet and they're yellow and turning a little brown, they become so delicious to cook. And bacon, of course, is salty, and bacon is bacon. Bacon has that umami flavor we all love. And in combination, they make this very delicious, easy breakfast dish from Honduras. And that was part of what I wanted to do in this book. It was to demystify Latin American food. It's not all spicy. It's not all cheese laden. It's not all covered in sauces. And you will find a lot of similarities between the food of Latin America and foods that you're, you know, used to eating here. So, you know, like your potato hash with bacon, or your casseroles that you have with potatoes or sweet potatoes and chives. This is a very simple rendition of a hash. And it's just plantains that are cooked in rendered bacon fat. And then you add the crispy bacon to it and you top it with a fried egg. And it's just, an amazing breakfast.
Now let's talk about using those plantains. Now when we want them in that less ripe, that's easy to tell. When I get plantains, I let it look like they're rotting on the outside, like the peel is getting black, and then they're ready for this kind of recipe, right? That means the inside is ripe.
That's right. Yeah, it almost looks like it's rotting, and that's the amazing thing about it. But at that point, it's sweet. But the fun thing about it is that if you buy them when they're still green, you can actually shred them. You can cut them into big pieces and double fry them. So you fry them once and then you mash it down into a chip and then you fry it a second time. Those are called tostones. And I offer a lot of recipes with all the different kinds of or different styles of ripeness of the plantains, the stages. And I do with many, many ingredients in the book. This is an ingredient-based cookbook. Mm-hmm. Because I find that many of the cuisines have the same ingredients that thread them together, even though they produce completely different results. And that was important for me. It is essential that people get to know the food of your neighbors. I don't know why in the United States we went so far into first exploring the food of Asia and the Middle East and all the cookbooks, you know, from Europe. And we have truly left Latin America on the side when it is actually a fascinating melting pot of global flavors.
You mentioned you organized the cookbook. I was expecting country by country. No, it's some base ingredients. One of them is corn. I like corn. Can you talk about some of the varieties of ways that corn is used across these 21 countries?
Yes, I call corn the backbone of the Americas. It's the one ingredient we all have in common, North America into Central America into South America. And corn in Latin America has very different ways of being used. You can use it raw like we use it here and eat it in salads like the esquite salad in Mexico. Or you can nixtamalize it, which means that you get your flint corn or heirloom corn and make it go through a chemical reaction where you put it in water that has been treated with calcium hydroxide, which makes the heirloom corn lose its outer kernel. And then that is what you mill and you make masa from, and that is what you make tortillas and tamales from. But once you go into South America, the corn goes into a different chemical reaction and a different way of processing it, and you get this flour, which is also instant, like your masa harina, but it is pre-cooked flour. Masa harina has not been pre-cooked. It's called masa arepa or arepa flour, and you make these corn cakes that are truly delectable. They're mostly found in Venezuela and in Colombia, and they can be different thicknesses, but it's not pliable. They're not pliable like tortillas where you can fold around the food. These actually serve as bases or as bread or as a sandwich that you can actually cut through in the middle. And the outside of it is like toasty and wonderfully crispy and delicious, but the inside remains soft like polenta, and that is the flavor that you get, and that's different from tortillas. And then, of course, you cook them, you put them in stews. It depends where you are, the different uses of corn, but it is the ingredient that is central to all of the cuisines of the Americas.
It's Food Friday, talking to Sandra Gutierrez about her new cookbook, Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. All right, Sandra, a great food that's in abundance in Wisconsin right now is squash, our winter squash. There's still some summer squash lurking out there as well. That is one of your ingredients. Can you share some inspiration? Let's go with winter squash. I know you've got some butternut and things like that. What's a good inspiration from your travels and journeys for us to do here in Wisconsin with our winter squash?
There's a wonderful locro, or a special soup from Ecuador, that's made with potato and squash, and then they add fresh cheese to it. It is subtle, it is warm, and of course, you know, it embraces you on a cold night, but it also has this depth of flavor that there's no spice in it, there's no heat in it in terms of chiles, but it has a little bit of cumin, and it offers you this delicious new twist on what would be a normal butternut squash soup. It's really, really good. We also cook squashes in sweet recipes, so you will find them transformed into jams and jellies. You will find them used in the summer squash. You will find use in a dish from Mexico called calabacitas, which is simply stir-fried zucchini and yellow squash with pimentos and with tomatoes and onions, and it's really delicious. You make it in about 20 minutes and you serve it with your dinner, or you can top pasta with it or do a lot of other things. The point of each one of these ingredients is that once it falls into the hands of the different groups of people who are already in the countries but also descend into the countries from different parts of the world, they get changed and transformed into dishes that are not as different as those that you've tasted before. So everybody's used now to having a butternut squash soup or a bisque in the fall and winter. You will find different renditions of that in Latin America. And that's what I wanted my readers to take and the cooks to find, recipes that don't ask them to take a very big leap of faith where they're going to go, oh my goodness, that sounds so weird. But on the contrary, there are things that they can say, well, I love minestrone soup, so that means I will love the minestra from Argentina, which is a similar soup. Or I love pasta sauce, and I would love to try the Peruvian pasta sauce that's made, again, with annatto, which you use to color cheddar cheese, and different ingredients, and has actually no tomatoes. So all these different ideas that I want people to feel comfortable trying, because it only takes a little bit of imagination to say, I know what it resembles, and you don't have to feel like I'm sending you through this voyage of very exotic, different foods.
Now, Sandra, as I mentioned, there's like 300 recipes in this book. That sounds like a lot, but I understand you narrowed this down from the thousands of recipes. Do you have a sequel concept in the works? Because you got a lot more material lying around.
I have boxes and boxes of recipes lying around. And it was really hard to make the cut. I went from 9,000 to 3,000 to 2,000. And then my editor started saying, you know, cutting and cutting, because you can't make a book that big. It would take, you know, a train to carry each book. It already is a big book as it is. But I tried to find the recipes that represent, like I told you at the beginning, food that home cooks are making today in their homes. So with modern equipment like blenders and food processors and things that really will, I think resonate to the American cook today. So there are recipes with very easy ingredients to find, not expensive recipes to make, and things that are similar to other foods that people have had before, which will give you a nice picture of the kinds of food that Latin Americans eat. It's not what most people think. It's not, you know, the iguana from the jungle in Guatemala that you have to macerate in chiles for 7 days before you cook it, you know, or weird recipes like that. We actually eat very similar food. So nice chicken cooked in coconut that will remind you of a Thai curry, but it's actually from Panama.
Fantastic.
Or, you know, a delicious soup that will remind you of a chowder because it's made with coconut milk, but it's actually from Belize.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our Food Friday guest, Sandra Gutierrez. Her new book is called Latinissimo, Home Recipes from the 21 Countries of Latin America. You can find a couple recipes from the book over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Today is being celebrated as National Sandwich Day. Why today? It marks supposedly the birthday of the English 4th Earl of Sandwich, whose cook came up with the idea of putting stuff between two pieces of toast so the Earl could have something to eat while gambling. That probably wasn't the first ever sandwich, but that's where the name comes from. And some sandwich restaurant chains are offering deals today. I didn't know about that at lunchtime. I just ate some soup that I made last night for lunch today. Now I have sandwiches on the brain, but I also have Latin American food on my mind from Food Friday. Good news, I can do both. We're going to pick up Mexican food to bring over to my mother-in-law's, and the restaurant makes tortas, delicious Mexican sandwiches, so my dinner plan is coming together. Everything's coming up, Rob. This is Central Time.